Okay, I think we'll begin our hearing. I'm not going to call it to order at this time. We don't have a quorum presently, but I would like to get started. So since it is an informational hearing, we can start the process here. We do have, today we're going to be doing the informational hearing on invasive species, and we do have four individuals that are going to be testifying today. The first one on the agenda, Luke Skinner. Okay. And Steve Hirsch. From the DNR. Thank you very much for joining us today for a very important issue. And let's see, Mr. Skinner, are you going to begin?
Mr. Chairman, I'll just start to give a brief introduction. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, my name is Steve Hirsch. I'm the Ecological Resources Director, and Ecological Resources is a division that's in charge of managing invasive species programs for the department. And I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today and update you on our programs. I think we all know that invasive species issues are some of the most complex and challenging natural resource issues that we're dealing with today. And Dr. Skinner is going to provide some information about some of the species of particular concern, give a little bit of information about our programs, and also talk a little bit about the stakeholder meetings that we recently held. I'd just like to say that with a program like invasive species, these are programs that constantly require evaluation and refinement, and they're not programs where the status quo is acceptable. I think we all know that. That was one of the reasons why we did these stakeholder meetings, and I'd just like to thank Minnesota Waters also, who helped us put these on. We got a lot of very good feedback from them, and so I think I'll just have Dr. Skinner go ahead and introduce himself and then go through the presentation, and then we can try to answer any questions.
Welcome, Dr. Skinner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Luke Skinner. I supervise the invasive species program for the Minnesota DNR in the Division of Ecological Resources. And I have a little presentation, and I'd like to kind of go over our program in a nutshell and talk about some of the key invasive species. And I'm really going to focus on aquatics and talk a little bit about the challenges for the future as we move forward. I'm going to focus this presentation mainly on prevention, prevention of the movement of invasive species into and within the state. The first one is just to let you know that we're talking about a lot of different species. We focus on the key ones of Asian carp and zebra mussels, but there's many species out there, including curly pondweed, you have the zebra mussels, Eurasian water milfoil, spiny water flea, Asian carp, purple loosestrife. But right now, there's a few that are really driving the concern out there, and particularly Asian carp and zebra mussels. So there's quite a variety, and they get here in a variety of ways. Some of the key pathway that most people think about is recreational boats. When you're talking about aquatic invasive species, you're thinking about boats and movement of recreational boats from lake to lake. But there's a variety of ways that invasive species get into and within the state. Up in your upper left corner, you're talking about fishing equipment is one way. You can get on your boat and your boots and your waders, especially the felt-soled waders can carry spores of different species and even eggs of different species on them. We've seen that from whirling disease to others getting transported from waters to waters. Down the lower left, you see ballast water has been one of the biggest issues of how they originally get into the state. Now, most ocean-going vessels are required to change their ballast water at sea, so to 90% solution of salt water, which really kills most of those invasives. But still, there's that transport between the Great Lakes that's still ongoing. The top middle, of course, is boats, and this is one of the primary pathways, but it's not the only one. One of the things we see now with this, you see water is a big movement. You see vegetation hanging on the trailers or on the transoms and such. But water is one of the biggest issues with spiny water fleas and zebra mussels. In the middle bottom, you see a fish we call pacu, which is actually it's like a vegetarian piranha. It actually eats nuts and other things in South America, and people have it in their aquariums, and it gets too big, and what do you think they do? They dump them in the local lakes or ponds because they don't want to kill them. And so these things get, but we see goldfish and these and a variety of other species in our waters. Up in the upper left, we'll talk a little bit about coming up, is the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, where they built the canal between Lake Michigan and which connects down to the Mississippi River, which is the only connection to connect to the major water basins in the country, with the Mississippi Basin and the Great Lakes. And now you have movement both directions of species going up and coming down in between these large basins, which is a real concern. And last but not least, just another example, is the water gardening trade. It's a booming industry where water gardens and landscapes are being put in all around, and people are purchasing plants from all over the country and sometimes the world, and are introducing new species into the U.S., into the state. So boat movement is one, but there's a lot of different ways that things can move. Our program has been around since 1990 when it was first formed by the legislature to curb the spread of aquatic invasive species, particularly plants and animals. And since then, our budget has grown over the years. And during the 2007 legislative session, the budget was nearly doubled, mostly to the addition of general fund dollars to our water rec account funds, which was surcharge on boat license. And currently, that is $5. Annually, actually a $5 surcharge on boat license, which is a three-year license. And you can see between fiscal year 08 and fiscal year 09, our budget close to doubled. And with that, there were some significant changes came to the program. First, we actually hired and brought on nine conservation officers who spend approximately about half their time doing nothing but enforcing invasive species laws. They work with our local conservation officers to do targeted events around the state, really ramping up invasive species enforcement around the state. So that's a significant change. Previously, we were relying on the conservation officers that were currently around the state. There's 155 local conservation officers who have to enforce all game and fish laws as well as invasives and such. And so having targeted enforcement efforts really has helped ramp up the efforts. Also, we doubled the number of hours that we do on watercraft inspections around the state. We target mostly infested waters, going to those lakes that have zebra mussels and milfoil and spiny water fleas, and trying to target boats leaving those lakes to try to prevent the spread. And last year alone, we did more than 66,000 inspections of boats and 42,000 hours statewide. It's a significant improvement over from just 2 years ago. The grant funding, or the funding was also used, the increase was used to fund grants, particularly prevention grants, which is given to the local units of government and other local entities to do local prevention awareness efforts and watercraft inspections. We offered $55,000 2 years ago, and this past summer we offered over $100,000 in grants. But the big change came with trying to manage curlyleaf pondweed and Eurasian water milfoil, where we nearly doubled our budget from $335,000 up to $700,000 to try to help lake associations and other groups trying to manage those impacts caused by milfoil and curlyleaf pondweed. So those are some of the significant increases that we've done in the state. One of the other ones we've done, just to mention, is we also added staff to the state. We have six invasive species specialists now that work directly with counties, local units of government, and with lake associations to help monitor and manage invasive species in their areas. And it's really been a real boon to have those folks on the field, in the ground, to work with those groups. So those are some of the significant changes in the last 2 years since the increase in budget. But with all that, you know, there's been a lot of challenges as well. So even though we know invasive species continue to spread in the state, if you look at some of the history here, just to give you a quick nod, the zebra mussels have been really spreading very slowly in the state, you know, part to do to the programs, part to do with the people out there acknowledging what's going on. But if you look at 2009, there was a blip. We started to see an increase in the state, which is the first time we've seen more than one lake. We saw multiple lakes infested with zebra mussels, and it's really caused a lot of concern. And as Steve mentioned before, we hear a lot from the public that status quo is not enough. The way we're doing business needs to change, or these species are going to continue to spread. And so in 2010, or 2009, we saw zebra mussels spread to four new areas of the state. We had Pike Lake just north of Duluth. We had Lake Lahamadu and the chain of lakes there right in Alexandria became infested in June. Pelican Lake right on the Otter Tail and Becker County borders, and Prior Lake actually at Ice Out last year was the first of the year. And this is a significant change from what we've seen before. We hadn't had a new population in the state for quite a while. We know the Mississippi River, which you can see there, and the Rum River has been infested for a long time, but this is a significant change. The Pelican Lake chain, Pelican Lake, the one furthest northwest, actually flows down into the Otter Tail River, which flows into the Red River. And I just got a call from Manitoba today, still concerned about this and what we're going to do some coordination work between the states and some of the Canadian provinces and how we're going to help prevent this spread over time. The other one is that spread, a new spread in the state also is spiny water flea. In the past, since 2008 and forward, and I'm sorry, before, spiny water flea was found all along the Canadian border waters with Minnesota, from Lake of the Woods all the way to Grand Marais area. And for the first time in 2009, we found it in Lake Mille Lacs. So now Mille Lacs has milfoil, zebra mussels, and spiny water fleas. And I'm concerned to a lot, for the first time, just about 1 year ago today, commercial fishermen caught 8 Asian carp as high as Winona in the Mississippi River, and 3 different species. They caught the grass carp, big head carp, and silver carp. There's been no carp caught since then, but it's a real alarm that we're starting to see them spreading up the Mississippi from Iowa up into the Minnesota Minnesota water border waters. So it's a real concern there. And we're hearing a lot about Chicago, and I'll get to that in a minute. So just a quick one about zebra mussels. They've been in the state since 1989, originally here through ballast water introduction. But right now, the main way they're spreading is on trailer boats, and that could be in water, in bait buckets, in live wells, and bilges. The young of the year zebra mussels, are called veligers, are free-floating in the water column, and they're microscopic. You cannot see them, so you do not know that you're spreading them. Also, zebra mussels, you can see in some of these pictures, attached to aquatic vegetation. So when you get a piece of vegetation on your boat, you can be transporting zebra mussels as well as a non-native plant such as milfoil. And so, again, trailer boats, the vegetation, and the water movement are the three ways, are the key ways that are being spread. And it's not all trailer boats. We're seeing the movement of docks and boat lifts that are sold from lake to lake from infested waters being moved to uninfested waters as a concern, especially up in the Brainerd Lakes area. We've seen that where they've actually stopped boat lifts that are being sold and transported, and they're covered with zebra mussels, and they need to be cleaned and kept out of the water before they are put back in a new lake. Again, spiny water fleas have mostly been found up along the border waters, you can see, and in Lake Superior. So it was a real surprise to find them down in Lake Mille Lacs this year. And most of the way they're spread is by collecting on fishing line and fishing gear and anchor ropes and things like that. They're not just in the water, but they actually collect on fishing gear, especially when anglers are bopping from lake to lake. If they're on a lake, for example, Lake of the Woods in the morning, and they stop at Mille Lacs to fish in the afternoon. This could be how they got there. It's likely that it was from some sort of recreational craft moving from lake to lake in this case. And we don't know what all the impacts of spiny water flea will be yet. This is one of the ones we're watching closely. It's very uncertain about what impacts they might have on the system. We know that small fish have a difficult time eating them. They have these sharp spines, as you can see, and they get caught in the throats of the small minnows that are used, that are bait fish for the game fish. But we're still tracking that. And the last one I just wanted to highlight for today is Asian carp. And there's really several species. And the three biggies are big head carp, black carp, and silver carp. Silver carp and big heads are the ones they've been catching in the river to date. They were introduced originally down in farms in southern United States, and they escaped in the Mississippi during flood times. And now they've been marching their way up the river over the last decade. And there's a real concern to threaten fisheries, wildlife resources, water recreation. If you've seen any of the footage of the jumping carp hitting people when they're out water skiing or in their boats, there's going to be some definite issues with that. I've actually included a map here of Chicago, just to let you know that there's this canal that connects Chicago. The Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal connects Lake Michigan to the Mississippi River eventually. And the carp are marching their way up this. And one of the ways they wanted to try to stop this spread of the carp is there's an electrical barrier. If you look down the lower left corner, there's a little circle, orange circle with a fish in it. They actually put 2 barriers now in the river there, trying to spread, originally, round gobies from spreading from Lake Michigan down into the Mississippi, and now upstream for carp moving upstream. One of the concerns, though, is they've been doing some testing in the river above the barriers using this new, what they call eDNA, basically some environmental DNA, where they sample the water for the DNA of the carp, and they've actually found these positive tests or designation detections of above the barrier. And they have not caught any carp up there, but it shows concern that they might have already breached the barriers and moving up toward Lake Michigan. The state of Michigan actually sued the federal government, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the city of Chicago and others to stop two of the to close 2 of the locks along there that they could help prevent the spread, and as an emergency action until they found new methods or different methods to prevent the spread. And that was actually supported by Minnesota AG's office along with, Wisconsin, and it did not, and it was not heard. They passed over it, and right now they're trying to develop a plan to do that. So they've got a short-term plan of trying to do more treatments in the river to kill the carp, install another barrier. At the same time, they're trying to do a study over the next 2 years to figure out ways they can limit the spread. But really, to limit the spread, you have to basically separate the basins again. That's the only way you're really going to stop the spread, is to actually close them off. And I'm not sure if that's ever going to happen with the industry that goes through there right now, especially in light of the recent court ruling. So real concern. So now we have them coming up the Mississippi and potentially now through the Great Lakes, but we have no indication that they're in Lake Michigan yet. In the Mississippi River, what are our options to slow the spread? One of the original studies that we did looked at using sound and bubble barriers at a lock and dam to help prevent or slow the spread of the Asian carp. 2 years ago, there was bonding money that was provided for design and pre-design and design work for the barriers, and we're still trying to work with the Corps of Engineers, who really runs the river in that system, to be able to do something like that. An alternative option that's further upstream is looking at the Coon Rapids Dam and maintaining that as a potential fish barrier, which it is right now, to help spread up in the upper parts of the Mississippi River. Well, overall, we have two main goals from our state plan to try to prevent the spread of invasive species in the state. One is to seek to prevent introduction of new species into the state, and the second is to try to contain those species once they get established here in Minnesota. And there's a variety of different strategies that we use. We use regulations, and then we need enforcement to enforce those regulations. We use watercraft inspections, public awareness, signage, and also we put permits and conditions on certain activities. This is really about people and their behaviors, whether it's recreational boaters to industry, just to private use and things like that. So it's a real variety, and it's really trying to change those behaviors across the state. And the first one we mentioned earlier was enforcement. In 2008, we added 8 new officers working nearly 50% of their time around the state. And it's really made a big difference in the way we can get at some of those issues. And those conservation officers work closely with the local officers and local units of government, trying to target key areas and activities to help prevent the spread. It could be from boaters like this. It could be from Asian food markets. It could be from minnow dealers and bait dealers and aquatic plant management operators, a variety of different ways things spread. And this is really a real focus of ours over the next couple of years, is to really boost this and really take advantage of this opportunity to get the word out. There are several regulations that are in place that are being enforced, and I highlighted 3 key regulations. First, it is illegal to transport aquatic plants on public roads right now, and that is a civil citation. The second is that you cannot possess, transport, or introduce prohibited invasive species such as zebra mussels. And third, designated water that is infested, so like Mille Lacs Lake that we have designated as infested waters, it is illegal to move water from those lakes. And if zebra mussel infested waters, you're required to pull your drain plug from your boat. And there's also restriction on bait harvest from those. So there's 3. You can't move aquatic plants, you can't move the invasive species, and you can't move the water that comes from infested waters. And those are really the 3 kind of cornerstones that we use to try to prevent this spread of invasives. And there's a lot of penalties out there right now. You can see the civil citations. There are misdemeanors for certain the activities. And for gross negligence or for flagrant violators, there is a gross misdemeanor as well. One of the great challenges we'll talk about is aquatic plants, which is one of the real challenges. Right now it's only a civil citation, and being able to bump it up to a misdemeanor, to a criminal, gives a lot more opportunities to take advantage of that, especially with all the new risks with zebra mussels being spread in that way. Our watercraft inspection program, as I mentioned, has been a cornerstone as well. We hired over 80 inspectors last year, and they checked over 66,000 boats statewide. 85% of that is focused on infested waters, trying to get to those folks that are leaving waters of the state that are infested. There's so many other lakes that aren't infested, it's very difficult to get to all of them. We do provide some grant opportunities and some cost share with uninfested waters, but 85% of our time is really trying to keep it from spreading from those waters that are infested. Public awareness has also been a big tool of ours, whether it's through mass media, radio, TV, billboards, but we also work locally with newspapers and provide a lot of information to boaters and anglers, resorters, all around the state on invasive species. We also post signs at all public accesses. The one in the upper right is one that's at all lakes. Now we're trying to put this at every public access in the state. We're even providing it free to all private accesses to help get the word out about stopping the spread of invasives. And the lower sign, the orange one, is an alert sign for those designated infested waters, and we actually put decals on there for which species are infested, and it's usually accompanied with another sign that talks about the specific regulations below. And these are some keys. You wouldn't think it, but when we did our surveys, that signs at accesses were one of the things that people actually read the most, where they get their information. We ask them where they get it. They get it from signs. They do get it from some from billboards and radio and such. But also the fishing regulations was another place that people read it. We've actually boosted the information in our fishing regs as well, and boating regs. One thing you might not have thought about, we also put permits and conditions on movement of water. A classic example is in Ramsey County, they want to pull water from Sucker Lake, which is in the Badness Chain of Lakes, which is infested with zebra mussels, into Snail Lake. And Snail Lake does not have zebra mussels. And so before they were allowed to pump water in the lake, because they want water in the lake to help keep it high, because it doesn't have a natural source, and so the lake continues to drop, they had to install this very sophisticated filtering system that takes it down to 20 microns. It goes from 200 down to 20. It cost several hundred thousand dollars to install, and they had a consortium up there of local units of government and others that actually installed this and put it to work this past fall. It took over a year and a half to design and get in place prior to that, and their water levels dropped significantly in the lake in this time, but we really don't want to spread to other lakes and continue to feed the chain. Another one is up in Representative Eakin's area up in Polk County and Union Lake. This lake water continues to get high, and they have no way of getting the water out of the lake unless they pump it. And this lake is infested with Eurasian water milfoil up on Union Lake. And so what you see is a giant filter system, and you can imagine just getting up to those giant tubes on the top is about 6 feet. This is to help keep milfoil from spreading out of the lake. And where they pump the water out of this lake, it flows into a whole new watershed, which flows into the Red River, again, a whole new source. And so they're installing this spring to help, and this way they can pump water out and keep the water levels from rising and flooding out the homes on the lake. So a couple of key filtration systems that are being installed to help prevent the spread of invasives in the state. The other thing we do is we provide grants to lake associations and local partners for watercraft inspections, but also for local public awareness products, as you can see up here. And we try to get that personal responsibility message out there. This one says, I made the commitment to stop invasive species, have you? And this is a local fishing guide up in the Hubbard County area. And the idea is really to get that local presence, that local concern, and make it more about everybody that needs to change that behavior, not just the state always telling them it's something that they need to do. And it's been very effective in certain counties. They've really taken advantage of this type of effort. As we said, these are some of the things we're working on, but it's not the end. And we know that invasive species will continue to spread unless we take more aggressive action in certain areas. And we wanted to go out and talk to the public about this and figure out, we want to hear from them what they thought about this, not just how we're doing, but what can we do differently and what can we do at a local level and not just at the state. We held 5 open houses around the state in conjunction with Minnesota Waters. And we had more than 200 people participate around the state. We had small focus group meetings with local leaders during the day, and we held open houses at night. And a couple of them, the bigger ones, Walker, we had close to 70 people and close to 90 people in Wilmer. People are really concerned about this and really wanted to let us know what they thought about this. And some of the main concerns are the ones
Mr.
we've already mentioned.
Mr. Chair, that was me in the picture. I was way in the back.
Oh,
I just want to put
that the Minnesota, did you University of Minnesota.
That's right.
Sweatshirt. You can represent John. I didn't even catch that.
There, I see it. Yeah.
All right.
Some of the same concerns that we just mentioned are what we heard from the public. Asian carp, zebra mussels, milfoil, and curly pond. We were 4 of the species that kept coming up over and over again. And the big concern, one of the number one concerns, is about the spread of zebra mussels from lake to lake and how we're really going to stop that and how we're going to make a real change to what we do. And the challenge of raising public awareness at all levels, from the local up to the legislative, and really using accurate information so people really know what the problems are. And of course, we did hear about prevention of movement of Asian carp as well. And some of the prevention ideas that are coming out of this is one is regulations. Increasing penalties and broadening regulations around invasive species. And one I mentioned earlier is this misdemeanor to transport aquatic plants. By increasing it to a misdemeanor, criminal penalty versus civil, provides more options for conservation officers in the field to be able to take action. And we're at a time that we're not allowed, it's not about education anymore. We've been talking education for a long time. It's now about action, and it's really about taking personal responsibility and having the tools to be able to do that and enforce these laws is very important. Another one that came out was requiring the idea of requiring draining of all boats from all waters by removing the drain plug is one. So right now you're required to move your drain plug from infested waters that contain zebra mussels or spiny water flea, but not all lakes. And so they're saying if you pull your plug everywhere, it's just a good practice to do to drain all water to really reduce the risk of spread, partly because we don't know where all the invasive species are, as well as the ones we do. So it makes a difference there. One that we had a lot of discussion at all meetings was about restriction of accesses, and in various forms, to complete closures, to moratoriums on new accesses being developed until we can figure out how to stop the spread, to just closure at certain times to require inspections of all boats leaving lakes. So the restriction and the require of inspections a lot of times go hand in hand. Especially lakeshore residents and lake associations and others say if you're going to we need to restrict access, funnel people through certain access points, and then require inspections. It's a difficult thing, and it's also one that would take a lot more conversation at the legislative level and not just at the DNR as well as others. Many user groups that I'm sure would have opinions on this, but there's various forms of that, but they think that this is what's going to make the difference. Having people change their behaviors can only go so far until we have to start taking more drastic or more aggressive measures. Also came up in the meetings some license and registration type of ideas, including requiring training of lake-related professionals. These are the folks that move your docks and boat lifts. They're the fishing guides. They're the ones that work on your boats and motors and move them from lake to lake. Those group, we've tried to work with those over the past couple of years to train them, but they're significant. They can bump from 20 to 30 lakes in a day, moving boats and trailers and docks. And some of the dock haulers we met with are very interested in working with us on this as well, but how we require training would be yet to be determined. Another one that came up was requiring licensing or training of boat operators, not just licensing, having a license for boats, a boat license, but actually boat operators, kind of albeit to the idea of the ATVs or the ATV or snowmobile license for operators in that kind of light, where they actually need training. That way they can be trained to know it, not just about safety, but also about invasive species, and try to increase awareness that way. We also heard that we need to do more increased inspections and enforcement statewide. Of course, this comes with a cost as well. And lastly, they talked about local partnerships, increasing funds, availability for grants for local groups. We've already given out $100,000 this year. We're hoping to increase it with some federal funding that we're getting. But it's a good way to engage the locals. The state can act as kind of this overall core screen. We are out there trying to help prevent the spread from those, on a statewide basis. But local, whether it's a county, a watershed district, a lake association, can do more at the local level to act as a shield to help prevent the spread in certain cases. And trying to support them in those efforts is really important. And with that, that's kind of the summary of some of the things we heard at the stakeholder meetings. And we're compiling a report that will be out hopefully shortly back to all those who participated with some of these ideas. These were just a few of the nuggets that came out of it. But again, there was a lot of discussion about all these, and the folks out there are really excited to be able to come and talk to us about this and see where we can take it from here. And at this point, I would just like to thank you for giving us the time to talk about this and open it to questions.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Skinner. And just before we start with questions, we do have a quorum, so I will officially call the hearing to order. And we do need to approve the minutes also from the last meeting of February 11th. Representative Drazkowski. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to approve the minutes from the last meeting.
Representative Drazkowski moves that we approve the minutes from February 11th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. And as far as questions, first of all, Dr. Skinner, thank you very much for the presentation. And I was wondering, given the limited resources we have to work with, and it's obvious this is a huge problem, we want to spend our resources where they, you know, get the biggest bang for the buck here. Where would you say the most effective strategies lie? Is it in prevention or penalties, or if you could, I guess, elaborate on that a little bit, give us some guidance.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, on when it comes to prevention, I think increased awareness, having good, strong laws that we can enforce makes it much easier. I think if you can have, as we always say, you can do the education, but if you don't have the hammer to bring down when there is a violator to really put it in place, that's what's going to change behavior. There's no way we can inspect every single boat that comes off a lake statewide. You know, we have, what, over 800,000 watercraft registered in Minnesota. And on Lake Mille Lacs alone, there's 400,000 angler visits a year. Even if you put two people in a boat, that's 400,000, you know, that's 200,000 boats. It's a lot. And so we need to target our efforts on those areas and strengthen our laws so we can have that ability to enforce them when we have the opportunity. So I think those are two. And also looking for local partnerships. We really need to be able to develop ways to work with watershed districts and local lake associations and counties to empower them to be able to do more. And one of those might be local law enforcement, you know, taking in more initiative and enforcing the invasive species laws, as well as doing more actions, you know, local inspections and things like that. So I think those are some of the key ones that we can do.
Thank you. And Representative Junkie.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for having this meeting, and thank you for having the meetings around the state. I guess to follow up on what you said and to ask the DNR, I think what we need from you in the next couple of weeks, remember our members, our policy deadlines are probably 4 weeks from now. At two meetings a week, that's eight meetings. And I don't want to wait for some report that's going to come a month or two from now from you with some suggestions. If there's things we can do today, we should be doing them. I guess what I'm asking you to do is put together some guidelines. What can we do now, today, this year, soon? And then what are longer-term goals? What you know, let me give you examples. The meeting in Wilmer was very good. There were so many people, they actually put on their presentation twice because the room was so packed. They had to, once it cleared out, we filled it up again and did it. But one of the things that came out of there that we could do immediately was boat plugs. There's no reason everyone shouldn't just pull their plug when they get out of the water, period. That doesn't hurt anyone. It doesn't cost any money. And what do we find out? Again, if zebra mussel is out of water, for how many hours will it survive on a normal summer 75, 80 degree day, normal humidity?
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, zebra mussel veligers, particularly what you're talking about in water, are actually pretty fragile. So if you drain all your water on a normal day when it gets pretty warm, you really reduce the risk significantly to spread. So that's it's hard to say exactly how much, but veligers are not, they're not tough. It's the adult zebra mussels that are attached to vegetation that can last 4 to 5 days out of water. But if you drain your bilge and your live wells and everything out and pull your drain plug, and it's going to reduce it significantly.
Yeah, and so again, members, that was something, as you had this room full of anglers talking about how we can preserve our lakes in our county, in our area, and we're 45 miles away from Alexandria where they have zebra mussels. I mean, these people were excited, and they wanted something done, and that was something I think we could do right away. So I'd like some information what we can do right away, and then what would be more longer-term goals. The other one we could do, and again, I know everyone talks about it, but you brought up the penalties and the fines. And again, when you look at the fine, fail to drain your water out of your boat, $50. So, I mean, honestly, you're right. That means nothing to most people. That's just the cost of fishing on a day if you get caught with that type of fine. And that was the comments in the room of a couple hundred anglers, and they were all agreeing. They said that needs to be stiffened. They're higher penalty. Not necessarily misdemeanor, but, you know, $250, $500, it's etched in your mind then. Yes, pull the plug, drain your water. Longer-term ones that they talked about were boat inspections. I mean, and again, my county, they were talking that night, how can we not allow people to move across county lines, much less zones in Minnesota? But again, at a minimal thing, how do we establish perhaps an inspection program for boats that are coming in from other states? That one seems pretty simple. You cross the border, by a non-resident license, and you get a non-resident inspection certificate on your boat saying it's clean, and you're not bringing anything in before you dump it into Minnesota waters and bring things. But, you know, again, that's a longer term that would take some training on, you know, license station people and whatever it is. But all these things were good ideas. And all of them, I think, at least the people that were I represent and that were in that room, hundreds of them that night, are demanding something be done quickly, and that we move vigorously on prevention of these aquatic invasives, because they're so close to getting into so many of our lakes that there's just some real frustration out there. And the frustration comes, frankly, from watching milfoil and other things just continue to spread without any real, what they perceive as real plan. But now zebra mussels are something that we think we can get on top of very rapidly in this case and do something. So I guess we're looking for guidance. I don't know if you're putting together an omnibus bill policy. You're certainly, I think, doing a game and fish bill. So I think there's some opportunities for some of these things moving forward. But again, we need some guidance from you, hopefully, and then we as a committee can have some discussion. So I just want to encourage you to do that.
Dr. Skinner?
Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to have to respond. Sure. And I had a question. Also, I was at a meeting in Detroit Lakes dealing with flowering rush and the concerns there. And it's something that hasn't really, you know, taken off across the state yet. It's still more localized. And I know one of the concerns was that sometimes the invasives that get the most attention are those that are the most widespread. And in other words, we wait until things get, you know, more out of hand before we really address it. I don't know if you could address that issue and whether there's any truth in that, that, you know, if it's affecting a small area, it doesn't get the attention that it maybe deserves, and then as a result, that invasive species becomes a greater problem later because we didn't nip it in the bud. And if you could also elaborate maybe on how how you determine which species maybe to go after the most aggressively. So those two questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, on the flowering rush, you're absolutely right. When flowering rush was first identified in Detroit Lakes early on, there was not enough information to know how impactful it would be. We spent a lot of time working on at that time in the early 90s on purple loosestrife and Eurasian water milfoil were the two biggies. We did continue to work with the group up there on flowering rush over time, and it has continued to spread in the lake. One of the challenges there is the difference between preventing the spread versus management. And in this case, we're talking about how do we manage a plant in a lake. Flowering rush turned out to be one of the most difficult plants that we could find trying to manage. It's just not good methods. And we're trying to still work with the Pelican River Watershed District and the local lake association and others on methods to do that. And we just held a research meeting with them, with researchers from around the country, about best methods and what can we do now differently to try to figure out ways to manage it. Flying rush was found in Lake Minnetonka this summer as well. And again, rapid response. We tried to manage what we found. We continued to survey the lake and found it in 52 different spots around the lake. So it had been there for a while as well. So we do that. One of the challenges you mentioned, number two, kind of leads to the first one, is we try to do risk assessments. We try to look at the risks associated with each species and try to determine which ones are the most important ones trying to manage. The challenge with something like zebra mussels is there are no control methods. And so prevention is the only thing we have. So we're trying to prevent the spread once it gets into a lake. With Eurasian water milfoil and curly leaf pondweed, we have some tools. You know, whether it's harvesting, mechanical, cultural, or herbicides, there are some tools that can help manage the impacts that they have. And they're trying to do that with flowering rush. With purple loosestrife, we found biocontrol that's fairly effective. And right now, statewide, we're seeing landscape scale reductions of purple loosestrife on the landscape. And that's right now kind of the aberration, you know, to actually be able to find invasive species that we can reduce. We'll still find it all around the state. We'll still have purple flowering plants in the metro and around, but overall it's being reduced on a statewide basis by biocontrol. But again, that's not the norm. That's the exception. So we try to do risk assessments to look at these species and then try to then prioritize our efforts that way.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of following up on a couple of things that have been brought up, in particular by Representative Junkin, it certainly seems that we are beyond the education stage in some of this stuff. And I thank you for talking about the history here. We've been working on a lot of these things for couple of decades and not winning, but I do want to go back to the education a little bit, because I know that was an emphasis that we had some decades ago. I've been a science professional for 31 years and been involved in the natural resource arena, and I kept seeing purple loosestrife coming north, coming up in the Bemidji-Cass Lake area. See it in the road ditches. And so, okay, well, who's doing anything about that? And I couldn't find anybody that even, you know, gave a care, didn't seem like, going up 25 highway up there through Foley. And so I just, where I'm headed here is, with education, do we have, after all the years we spent some years and some dollars on this, do we have some assessment of what works and what doesn't work? Are we out there talking to high school kids and say, have you ever heard of purple loosestrife? Have you ever heard of zebra mussels, to see if our message is getting out? We got to do something different. I'm trying to throw out a challenge here, and hopefully you guys will come back with something that will meet that challenge.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we have done surveys working with Minnesota Seed Grant to find out what people know and how they behave regarding that, and we've actually targeted our messages and our campaigns around that. You know, the demographics for age of the people, from voters, where they're going, where they're coming from, what their likes and dislikes are, and whether they're taking action or not. So we've tried to target it that way. One thing we heard through the stakeholder groups, and which we know well, is getting to the kids is one of the big parts as well. You know, how many people know when we talk about, my son came home the other day and said, do we have a fire plan? Well, we certainly did within about a day, you know, because they keep harping on you, whether it's recycling or littering and all that. There's a real influence there. And so the kids is part of it. But we're also trying to get this major targeted group, especially the recreational anglers and boaters as well. So we do target that. The other thing we heard a lot about is, for a long time, as you mentioned, we talked about what the impacts were and what people need to do. Our message has really switched in the last 5 to 10 years, especially 5 years, really targeting action, what we want you to do. And what we're hearing back is that maybe people are forgetting about what the problem is, and so we need to take it back to the problem and impact. So it does help. As we get out this information, we do revise our tactics and go for it.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. This just came to me here when you were talking about the kids again, and just something to consider perhaps. You know, with the SWCDs, there's an education program, the Envirothon program, and they develop curricula for schools, and I know there's some of this in there, but it's conservation oriented, and golly, you know, we have some tools out there if we can plug them in and use them. Thank you.
Okay. And Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was at a MEI meeting at the beginning of the session, and a lot of questions from the audience, and one of the questions from the audience was asking us if we had ever considered raising boat fees on boats that move from lake to lake to be used, and that money be used for enforcement, because the boat that stays in the same lake is not causing the same problem. And is that something you all have considered? Did that come up in any of your meetings?
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius. Yes, actually it did come up. For the first time we heard that, there was somebody proposed a two-tiered system for boat licensing, one for those ones that stay local and one for those move. And I think it was, former Senator Wegscheid, Dan Wegscheid from up in Brainerd area, he proposed that at one of our stakeholder meetings, this idea of that, and then, didn't talk about how much, but trying to do that, a two-tiered system and some approach to target those boaters that are moving, and so more of a user fee-based, you know, approach. But they didn't have a lot of details, but he did bring that up at one of the stakeholder meetings. So, but we haven't discussed it in detail yet.
And Representative Wagenius.
I'm really curious to see how members of this committee would feel about something like that. I know there's been resistance to raise boat fees on all boats because some of them sit in the same lake and never go, and there's a fairness aspect there. But mm-hmm. If a boat is going from lake to lake, and those are the ones that are costing us more, should we raise the fee on those? just to pay for enforcement or education or whatever, not targeted to the invasives, I guess would be a better way of saying it. Do other folks have opinions on that?
Representative Junkie.
Well, just to the point of people that don't transport their boats much paying, I would venture, if I went to the Green Lake Lake Association and asked them about that, they'd be willing to pay more if it went to education on their boat that doesn't move, because they're the ones that are concerned. They're concerned about boats moving. They're concerned about education. They're concerned about what goes on at our boat lift or our boat launches and other places. So they would say, we want to be included, at least my lake owners that were at that meeting. They want to do whatever they can and do their part, so they would not want just a tiered system of, you know, if you transport your boat or trailer your boat, then you got to pay more. That's which somehow would hook to a trailer license or something. That I don't think they'd be willing to pay, as long as they knew the money was going straight to prevention and nowhere else.
It seems to me that as long as there's transporting between the lakes, there's always going to be a problem, unless you have a completely airtight system. And I don't know if it could ever reach a point where you could ever envision the possibility of even quarantine. I mean, that's the only way it seems to me that you could possibly have a sure-proof way of not having invasives spread from one lake to another. Or do you think that you could come up with a sure-proof method short of that?
Mr. Chairman, I think getting to zero risk of movement is not going to happen. I think we can reduce it. The more we do, the more aggressive we are, the more we can reduce the risk. There's so many pathways. I think, let's use Mille Lacs as an example. It has three species right now. If it's some people consider it, because of the amount of boats moving to and from it, it's a super spreader, potentially. And so we've already targeted more efforts around their enforcement, inspections, everything. We're loading up around some of these lakes that get heavy use. But we have to figure out a method to do it. If we try to put people at boat accesses right now and 24/7 around that lake, it would cost about $9 million a year for one lake just to be able to inspect every boat coming off that lake. There may be other ways to do it. And we'd also, you know, if we wanted to make a requirement that you have to be inspected after you leave, then it might be a different system. In some of the western states, they actually have boat inspection stations, and they have people required to get inspected and get a tag on their trailer before they can launch. The difference is they have a fraction of the boats that we have, you know, statewide. So if they're checking every boat coming in, you know, we're talking, if they have 800,000, they have less than 80,000. And they have eight stations statewide that they're doing inspections on. And the number of boats that they're checking is pretty small. And so just we have to think about scale and how we do it. Yes, you could probably really reduce the risk by inspecting all the boats, but we just have to figure out how to do that.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is, I actually have two of them, but one is just, you know, in looking at the efficiency of interventions you were mentioning with boats coming in from out of state and just moving around within the state, what percentage of licenses are purchased online and web-based so that they would not ever have the opportunity to talk with somebody about it?
Dr. Skinner.
You know,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd have to find that out. I do not know what the percentage. I think the online sales is pretty high now with the ELS, so I could find that out and let you know. I'm uncertain of that number.
Mr.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Skinner, I'm curious. I see the chart you have that kind of charts the numbers of new infestations of zebra mussels. But I'm curious about those places that have already been infested and what the kind of what the dynamics are there. I live in southeast Minnesota, and I spend a fair amount of time in the Mississippi River, and at least observations from myself and others have been that the zebra mussel populations after a while start to head south. Curious about what the impact is, how the ecosystem adjusts over time, and kind of what the observations and research tell us in that regard.
Dr. Skinner.
It really varies from lake to lake and river to river. On the Mississippi, as you're mentioning, Lake Pepin had huge populations. They really had a big outbreak. And then in some low water, warm low water and warm temperatures, there was a big die-off. And we saw some big changes in the river system over time. And it is typical of invasive species populations to build up high and then sometimes crash out a little bit and settle out at some other equilibrium, but it really depends on the lake. In Lake Ossawinamakee, which is a little lake north of Brainerd, which is one of the first inland lakes, has had it since 2003, and the population is steady. It's built up, it's high, the numbers are quite high in the lake, and they've been steady for the last 4 or 5 years. Our divers have been down there for the last 5 years straight. So it really depends on the system. Impact-wise, it's really going to vary as well. One of the number one concerns is that it's a filter feeder. And so some people say it's a good thing because it clears water, but when you do that, you can increase aquatic plant growth, for one. You actually can concentrate any sort of contaminants that are in the water in the feces that come out of them that build up on the bottom. They basically colonize on top of all of our native mussel species and can actually impact populations. And on a recreational basis, matter of fact, I had a guy who was renting a place down on Lake Pepin call and say, I can't believe, why didn't you warn me about this? My granddaughter went out swimming and now her knees and ankles are all cut up from the zebra mussels that were on the bottom when she went swimming in the lake. So there's recreational impacts, clogging of motors, and people are pulling water from lake, their intakes are being clogged. So there's those recreational impacts as well as the ecological ones. And so, but it varies from lake to lake. We're now monitoring Lake Mille Lacs very closely. We're working with our division of Fish and Wildlife, and we're looking at impacts to see what's going to happen over time. Not just the water quality and the plant communities, but we're going to look at the fish species from the base up to see what's going to happen over time. We're starting to do that on Lake Carlos now and the Lake Lahamadu in the Alexandria area. And from other places, Lake Oneida out east, they saw water clarity increase. They did not see their walleye populations change, but they saw behavior of fish change. And so it became much more of a night fishery. Fish went down in the clear water. But you're right. I think it's going to fluctuate on some areas. And right now, it's a real challenge for the folks living on those bodies of water and those users to figure out how to use it differently, you know, and to be able to maintain, because they will be impacted, but it's really hard to tell from lake to lake. But your observation is correct that you see some populations start to fluctuate.
And Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, my second question was with regard to knapweed, and wondering, you didn't touch on that one in your presentation. I was wondering what sorts of actions have you done or thought about doing or whatever with the gravel pit operators with regard to education and or anything else with that particularly important group?
Mr. Chairman, terrestrial invasive plants, especially noxious weeds, are actually regulated by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture in conjunction with the county agricultural inspectors. We work with them. We're on committees with them, work with them on it, but that's, I'd have to turn that over to MDA for that one. But there is some education going on. We have our own gravel pits in the DNR, and we're actually doing gravel pit surveys and now trying to do management. We have our own best management practices for terrestrial invasive plants on our own lands that we manage. As far as a regulatory Department of Agriculture would have to answer that one.
And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Skinner, I want to go back to the enforcement question since we've invested additional dollars in there. And just maybe, did I hear you correctly that you believe that the additional enforcement that we've invested in has worked? Is that correct?
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen. I think it is working. I mean, it was 2008 when we first brought them on. There was a learning curve. And this year, we saw more targeted enforcement efforts around the state, even in areas where that was uninfested. We saw more actions. We saw more tickets written. And we saw many, many more hours working on these issues around the state. Qualitatively, that's what we can tell. It's hard to measure. But I was struck by the amount of efforts that were going out there. And getting the local conservation officers involved, working with our specialist conservation officers has been I should say the other way around. The specialist working with the local conservation officers has really enforced the fact that it's not just game and fish laws that need to be enforced, but it's all of them. And we saw the Commissioner Holston last year made it a priority to do work and enforcement around Lake Mille Lacs, and we had special details around the lake because of that. And so I do think it's making a difference, and I think as we work with them with enforcement to do more detailed work plans, I think we're going to see it only get better.
Representative Hansen.
Then a follow-up on a somewhat different topic. We've read in the popular media a couple of articles that said that Asian carp could be taken care of by either incidental human consumption or coordinated commercial fishing, and I'd like your professional opinion on that as a solution for control.
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen. I am not convinced that commercial harvest of carp is the only sole ticket. I think, you know, preventing the spread, for one, up into reaches of the state is key. The second one is having good, healthy ecosystems out there that have good habitats for the native species to contend with are going to be more supportive. I mean, they're going to be more supportive of that, and they're going to be able, and those species are going to be able to maintain longer. But I don't think that commercial harvest of fish will be the only thing. I'm going to ask Steve to comment on that as well.
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, my old fisheries background is perking up here a little bit. And I would just offer, look at the common carp. And we've had commercial fishing going on for common carp for decades and decades. And fisheries has a lot of data on that, and not new data, but older data. And it shows that even when you take fairly large numbers of the fish, you really don't permanently knock them back. Even in a best-case scenario, it's very labor-intensive. You have to repeat it at intervals. And oftentimes, you just restructure the population from a few large fish to more smaller fish rather than actually make a significant dent over a period of time. So I agree with Dr. Skinner. I would be very skeptical that harvest in and of itself is a solution. You know, figuring out how to utilize those fish commercially may not be a bad thing. It may be a good thing. But unless it's done in conjunction with other things, I don't see it as something that's really going to be effective.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Skinner, you talked about having boats all pull a plug at the landing when they take off. What about the live well and the bait bucket? Are you talking about only pulling the plug on their boat themselves? And then if you could just comment, I mean, that would be a huge thing for folks to handle, but I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, that's one of the ideas, is just to pull the plug. Right now, on infested waters, you're required to you cannot transport any water from infested water, so you have to drain the live well. You can't have water in your bait bucket. Matter of fact, you're required to, you know, if you want to keep your minnows, we encourage you not to throw them away, but you have to exchange the water. You have to dump all the water out and exchange it. What anglers are doing now, for example, is they'll throw a couple of gallons of frozen, you know, frozen jugs of water in the back of their truck, and when they come off the lake, it's melted. They'll drain the water, you know, in the lake prior to leaving, and then they'll add new water before they leave. So there is challenges. It's a tough one to enforce as well. I mean, you've talked to enforcement, but the idea is to try to reduce the movement of water. So you could say you can go to that level, but it makes it much more challenging.
Representative McNamara.
So, Dr. Skinner, in your feelings there, then we would trust folks that they would have a different source of water available for their minnows or potentially their live well, maybe brought it from home, from their well water or their city water or whatever. I didn't think of that idea, and that seems like that would potentially make sense. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Skinner.
Right now on Lake Mille Lacs, for example, they have to do that, or any other zebra-mussel infested waters. Enforcement does try to target that, and our watercraft inspectors are telling everybody, this is the deal, you have to drain your water. And some people don't like it, but they're learning. They're learning, and resorters are taking advantage of it by giving out freezer bags to take your fishing. We're telling people, put your fish on ice. You don't need to keep it at home. You can't transport live fish anyway on public roads. But you're right. It's that challenge, and how do you word it and how you frame it so people are trying to reduce the movement of water.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next, we have Mr. Ray Johannes from the DNR. Is going to be speaking on VHS.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, my name is Roy Johannes. I represent the Division of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm planning on giving you an update on VHS, also known as viral hemorrhagic septicemia. I have one of the aides passing around a news article recently regarding some new findings in Lake Superior. And what I plan to do this afternoon is to give you an update on those new findings, and later on in my discussion today, I will give you an update of what we're doing in Minnesota as part of our DNR activities to deal with the virus. Cornell University is a very well-versed university in fish health, and recently they've developed new highly sensitive techniques used for testing for different types of viruses and pathogens in fish. And recently they came up with a method to test for VHS, and in 2008 and 2009 they did sample testing in Michigan and Wisconsin waters, and in 2009 they tested 874 fish and were able to confirm VHS findings in a small portion of those fish in Wisconsin and Michigan. Now there's a second type of new highly sensitive way of testing for VHS. It's called the viral end gene sampling method, which looks at RNA from viruses and is able to confirm another type of PCR testing that's used for identifying VHS. The typical use and methodology for testing of VHS is done by tissue culture through cell culture methods that have been done for many, many years. VHS has been found in the United States for over 40 years, and the virus that we're looking at right now is only been available since 2005. Originally, the VHS only infected cold water fish such as salmon and trout, and in 2005 it was found to start to impact cool and warm water fish, primarily muskie, walleye, northern pike, lake herring, and lake whitefish, which are the fish that are most sensitive. But there is also 38 species that are now identified as susceptible to the VHS virus in the Great Lakes. Their testing methods, though, right now, although they have been confirmed, they have not been confirmed by USDA APHIS, which uses the gold standard of tissue culture for determining the virus. So there's still some outcomes that need to come out of this research that was recently found. From a standpoint, we at DNR, from our fishery standpoint, we were very concerned about the findings that were first identified in 2005 in Lake St. Clair and expanded into four of the five Great Lakes previous to these findings in 2009. In 2007 in fisheries, we put together a plan of action to look at ways to monitor the virus and how it would approach Minnesota, and to look at ways that we would put into place for its prevention and identification. We knew that we had two key vectors, because if four of the five Great Lakes were infected, we knew Lake Superior would eventually become infected because of the traffic of fish, commercial netting activities that take place in both Lake Huron, Lakes Superior from the same group of people, and from other types of recreational and spread of water. The other area we're very concerned about, especially after 2008 findings, that the virus is found as far south as Milwaukee and Lake Michigan, and as Dr. Skinner talked about, the connection at the Chicago Ship Canal, that would be the same vector that zebra mussel showed up in Minnesota, going down the canal through the Illinois River up the Mississippi into our waters. We feel that that's a vector that we need to watch, a pathway the virus can enter the state. What we began doing as an agency was to look at ways that we needed to monitor how the virus could be found in the state. And fortunately, when USDA put its order in place for the restrictions on the transport of live fish in the eight Great Lakes states, they also provided grants for us to do surveillance type activities, and we were able to, because we were one of the eight Great Lakes states, we're eligible for receiving grants to test things. And what we did in 2007, we tested 86 lakes statewide, and we looked at all the watersheds throughout the states and did testing for VHS. We were also able to do that in 2008, and we were also able to get some of the grant money to start testing some of the private aquaculture farms in the state to help them out as far as finding out if VHS was present in any of the fish farms. We also have a grant that we were able to go from 2009 to 2010 for $89,000 to help us test for VHS in the state. Some of the key things that we did when we first looked at our operations for our fish production program, which is one of the largest in the country. We knew that we had to take necessary action to keep the virus from entering any of our waters. At the time in 2006, 2007, we did have a walleye spawning operation in the St. Louis estuary, which we chose to discontinue, not even take the risk of entering any eggs from those waters into our state. And we moved those over to what we call our tower or Hudson Bay drainage, our Pike River strain of fish from Lake Vermilion. We began surveillance testing with Wisconsin in the St. Louis Bay area, and fortunately for us, we have not identified any VHS in Lake Superior through our testing methods. We also have a hatchery up on the North Shore of French River. We discontinued use of that hatchery for short-term holding of fish. We raise a lot of trout in the southeast part of the state. We previously hauled those up to French River, and we distributed it to all the counties in the northeast part of the state from that hatchery. We set up three different holding facilities now to accommodate that. We have one in Grand Marais near Devil's Track Lake. We have one at Tower, and we also have one at Grand Rapids. We also discontinued using sucker fry as a forage for our muskie program. Previous to 2007, we hatched 750 quarts of sucker eggs, which we use for forage. We've transferred that program over to a dry diet feed right now. We have our staff have been trained to use dry diet to feed our muskies, and we no longer have to feed young fish to them that may be susceptible for those waters. We worked with legislature to pass laws regarding VHS to strengthen up the restriction of moving a fish in the state, require testing of fish as they entered Minnesota and as they were stocked in waters. In 2009, we took on a program to disinfect all the eggs that go into our hatcheries. Right now, there's a standard method using what's called iodine treatment or iodophore, and we surface disinfected all the eggs that came from our spawning stations. And just recently, the testing methods and research done by USGS has identified that that is a way to break the link of VHS from entering in the hatcheries of programs around the country. We did that in 2009. We'll continue to do that in the future. We've also continued to conduct surveillance activities through all of our production methods that we use for hatching and stocking fish that are susceptible. All of our walleye rearing ponds were tested last year. All of our muskie rearing ponds were tested for VHS, as well as our northern pike. So those are the actions that we have taken. And with the onset of things that with Lake Superior, we'll continue to do an outreach process. In 2008, we came up with the VHS brochure, which we have on our website. We'll need to update that because of new information we've been able to find on VHS. And we'll work hand in hand with our invasive species program. As Dr. Skinner alluded, there was many prevention methods that we can do. And with Lake Superior, which is already designated as an infested water for several invasive species, all the actions that he identified are already in place. An example is prevention methods are don't move live fish between water bodies. That's an important key. Do not move any water between water bodies, which is what he talked about. How to deal with your minnows and bait and so on. Drain your motor, your bilge, all your live wells and containers. One of the things that we found out with VHS, which is very a fragile virus, is that it can be heat killed with hot water. Water at 140 degrees can, if your boat is treated with that water and dried for 12 hours, it's found that VHS is killed. So with that, I'd be glad to take any questions about VHS and any recent updates that have taken place.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any procedures or policies or provisions that have been passed in other states that we have not done here that we should be doing?
Mr. Johannes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I believe we're on the forefront as far as the state agency goes, as far as putting in the necessary actions taking place for testing. We've also been identified as a very conservative state for people to raise fish and to bring fish into our state because of that. There is one state that does have more restrictive measures than we do, and that's New York, and that's because they've had to deal with the virus on a firsthand basis. One of the things we would look at is probably strengthening a couple of our statutes that we do have in place to help us if the virus did start showing up more in our state. And that would be one of allowing the movement of fish for aquarium use by young anglers.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Johannes. Next we have Mr. Mark Abrahamson. You'll be speaking about the emerald ash borer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Abrahamson. I'm an entomologist and also emerald ash borer project manager at Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So I'm going to give you a brief update on what's new with emerald ash borer. And I also have Bob Cook here along with me. He's also an entomologist at the Department of Agriculture, and he's the administrator for the Forest Protection Reserve Funds. And so if you have questions about that, Bob will address those. So an update on emerald ash borer in Minnesota. I believe you have a fact sheet that gives a kind of a brief overview of where we are with emerald ash borer. There's a map on the front of that page that shows nationwide the range that we know of emerald ash borer in North America. And you can see Minnesota's on that list. 2009 was the first year that emerald ash borer was discovered in Minnesota. There are actually two infestations that we're dealing with here in Minnesota. One is the one here in St. Paul, and the other is just outside Houston County in southeastern Minnesota, which appears to have began in or around Victory, Wisconsin, which is right on the border. As a result of those infestations, we have two separate quarantines on ash materials and hardwood firewood. One is on Houston County, and that is because of the proximity of the known infestation in Wisconsin. That the assumption is that there are also infested trees in Houston County. And then the other quarantine area is Hennepin and Ramsey counties here in the metro. And Ramsey County is the only county with confirmed infestation, but again, because of the proximity of Hennepin County to that infestation, both counties have been infested. To date, we have not found and confirmed any infested trees in Houston County, Minnesota. We've done extensive survey in the area throughout 2009, working with the primary land owners in the immediate area, which is U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And probably my best guess at why we haven't found infested trees is partly because the beetle appears to be moving along the river in Wisconsin, and also partly because there's a big difference in the habitat really between the sides of the border there. On the Wisconsin side, there's a Highway 35 running along the border, and there's a lot of smaller scrubby ash growing along that, whereas on the Minnesota side, it's actually a wildlife refuge in that part of the county, and it's a fairly mature forest with large trees. And what you would expect is the larger trees are going to take longer to show symptoms and be able to be identified as infested. Here in the Twin Cities Metro, originally the infestation was identified in May 2009, and that was through a report by a commercial arborist who alertly spotted symptoms of emerald ash borer on some trees in St. Paul and brought that to our attention. And since that discovery in May, we've had 83 trees that have been found and confirmed infested, 82 of them in St. Paul, one in Falcon Heights. I believe it was 68 of those trees were found right away in May and were removed and destroyed by the City of St. Paul. And then in working with the city and with also the University of Minnesota, we found an additional 15 trees that were confirmed and were also removed and destroyed. We're continuing to work with cooperators in the area, including City of St. Paul, City of Falcon Heights, City of Minneapolis, to identify potentially infested trees and have those addressed prior to summer when the beetles become active again. Other than that, I guess, in kind of the broad scheme of things, right away when EAB was discovered in the United States, the approach was to try and eradicate it, basically get rid of it from the from where it was found to occur. Since then, that really has met with nothing but failure. We've learned our lesson in that regard, that this isn't a pest we can eradicate. Number one, it's too hard to detect, so we've never find it early enough to get rid of it. Number two, it's very easy to spread, so it's been spread to lots of locations that we don't know about yet, most likely. So right now we're at a point where we're trying to find, kind of a new approach to EAB nationwide, I would say, where the eradication idea has been abandoned, yet we don't really quite have our hands on what exactly is going to constitute a management program for emerald ash borer. We're taking our best stab at it here in Minnesota. Certainly one of the primary components of any management program is going to have to be sanitation, removal of infested trees. So that's one of the cornerstones we're trying to base our operations on. One of the things we do have going for us here in Minnesota, I mentioned this was discovered by a commercial arborist, and I give him a lot of credit because we have one of the more early discovered infestations in terms of the country. The age of this infestation is estimated to be about 3 years when it was discovered in 2009, and we worked with USDA and then researchers at Michigan State to arrive at that conclusion. So basically, they analyzed samples from the trees and they can determine when they first became infested. So 2006 is the year that it looks like this infestation began, and that's about half the age at which these infestations are typically discovered. 5 or 6 years old is more the norm. And that gives us really a better handle on trying to take some actions to slow down the way this grows and spreads. One of the things that has become very clear from work in Michigan is that emerald ash borer population dynamics depend a lot on numbers. So in other words, as the numbers go up, it grows more quickly and it spreads more quickly. So being able to implement some measures that keep those numbers smaller by then should also limit the growth and spread of the infestation. And I think that's where we're at right now. We haven't had anything that's been discovered outside of about a mile wide area around the original infestation. There's the possibility always of other infestations being found, virtually anywhere in the state. As I mentioned, there's a lag in terms of when these are introduced and when they're discovered. So, we have to expect that we're going to find other places that do have infestations that may exist already. But as of right now, we have only the one confirmed in St. Paul area, and then the one also outside of southeastern Minnesota that we're concerned about. So with that brief update, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Abrahamson. I was wondering, you said that eradication really, that's not realistic or a real possibility. How about containment? Is there a realistic possibility for stopping its spread, or is it just to slow it down?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think probably the same is true for any approach to EAB. It's going to be a matter of trying to slow it rather than to stop or contain it. It's so easy for it to be moved. If someone has an infested ash tree, and if that tree is removed or even pruned and possibly made into firewood or just taken to a waste yard, it can be hauling that life stage within the wood and introducing it to that new area. So because there are so many potential movers of the bug, so many potential people who could be moving it, I don't think that it's something that can be contained forever, but if we can at least slow it down, then that buys time for other parts of the state to be more prepared for it to arrive there.
Sure. Thank you. And Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Abrahamson. First of all, so would you characterize the it being as inevitable that this pest is going to be eating ash trees throughout the state at some point in time. And then the other question would be, looking at the map here, what do we know about those areas where the infestation levels were high and, you know, natural control of those pests and the ability for natural controls, predators, whatever have you, to have them under control after that and allow for normal regeneration of the ash trees and you know, the symbiosis or whatever that might occur in the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Abrahamson.
Mr. Chair, Representative. In terms of inevitability, I would say that that probably is true, that it is inevitable. It is going to reach all parts of Minnesota, certainly. There is some very preliminary research looking at the ability of emerald ash borer to basically what is its overwintering hardiness, but that's in the very preliminary stages. It's possible that at some point that may have some impacts for Minnesota, but it's really hard to say at this point. In terms of other areas where emerald ash borer has occurred, there really, to my knowledge, has not been any natural control that's been seen. We do have parasitoids and predators that do attack ash borers we have that are native to North America. However, work that's been done in Michigan has not found much of an impact of those agents on emerald ash borer. In fact, there was such a low rate of natural occurring things attacking emerald ash borer that USDA actually sponsored work to look for agents in Asia to bring here and try to implement them in controlling emerald ash borer. That work too is it's progressing, but I think it's still awfully early to say what kind of an impact it has. I'm not sure it's been very clear what kind of an impact those agents have in Asia in terms of regulating emerald ash borer populations. In my opinion, it seems that resistance of the trees in Asia may be the biggest factor in why emerald ash borer is not a destructive pest in Asia, and yet it is here in North America. In areas where emerald ash borer has occurred so far, really, to my knowledge, the only ash trees left standing are the ones that have received insecticidal treatments, and those that haven't eventually are killed by the beetle up to 100%. One of the things that has been held out as a hope is that at some point we're going to see some resistance occurring naturally in North American ash trees, that we might have some pockets of trees that escape, and so they've got something about them that emerald ash borer doesn't like. It's also, you know, in that case, probably too early to really close the book on that subject. We've only got 8 years of experience now with emerald ash borer, but my knowledge that also hasn't been seen. So not to say that at some point it may not be, but it hasn't been yet.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for having the hearing about this. Mr. Abramson, I just have a couple of questions, and maybe you're not the right person, and that's okay if you're not, but in regards to the grants, I was surprised that we don't have any down in Houston County or up in northern Minnesota with the large population of ash trees in northern Minnesota specifically, or the presence down in Houston County. Do you know if any communities in those areas had applied for part of the grants?
And Mr. Abrahamson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to refer that question to Bob Cook. You can address that.
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Chair, I'm Bob Cook. Like Mark said, I'm another entomologist with the Department of Agriculture, and I'm administrating the grant program that we started up with the Forest Protection Reserve appropriation. And to address your question as to why none of the grants were made to locations or entities in northern Minnesota or down in the southeast, one ranking criteria in the evaluation process was proximity to a known infestation, and that was weighted fairly heavily because the main goal of the program was to slow the spread, so we wanted to try to get the resources focused near the infestation, so that may have had some impact on some of those far northern applicants. And if my memory serves me correctly, I don't think there were all that many from up in northern Minnesota. Southeastern Minnesota, I don't think we had any applications come in from Houston County. We do have Rochester and Red Wing both received grants. There are a few other communities from down there that did apply, but when the numbers were all tabulated, they ranked lower than we were able to stretch the funding.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I've got another one about the movement as far as material throughout the Twin Cities, and specifically the movement of mulch. Are we restricting the movement of mulch? Is it matter if it's an enclosed truck? I'm just starting to think of when we get into the season now and we're moving mulch throughout Hennepin, Dakota, and Ramsey County, and we're crossing the county restrictions. Do we allow them to move it in enclosed vans, or do we not allow them to come through the quarantine counties?
Mr. Abrahamson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, movement of mulch, yes, mulch is, if it's ash mulch, it's a regulated article. So other types, any other type of tree that would be turned into mulch would not be regulated, but ash mulch is. And yes, that is a regulated article, so it cannot leave, it cannot cross the quarantine boundary. And in the Twin Cities here, the quarantine boundary is drawn around Hennepin and Ramsey, so just moving between Hennepin and Ramsey is okay. But that material should not cross the quarantine boundary unless it's moving under a compliance agreement with the Department of Agriculture. And then that compliance agreement addresses the way that the product is treated, basically, but not necessarily transported. So the important thing with mulch would be that it would be ground to a fairly fine diameter, less than an inch in two dimensions. And that would be the criteria in allowing that mulch to leave the quarantine, not necessarily if it's covered or not covered.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you. And then, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my next question is in regards to tree removal on private property. Do we have in statute, I'm trying to remember, and I don't, I'm thinking some of the Dutch elm stuff might still qualify, but do we have in statute the requirement for the private property owner? Can the local municipality require the tree to be removed?
Mr. Abrahamson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding is that falls to local governments to enact requirements on private property. I believe that City of St. Paul has an ordinance in place to address private property removals. And, you know, I believe other local governments do as well. But it's my understanding that's the local government who addresses that.
And Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Abrahamson, I just wondered if you could clarify for me. I thought I heard you say that there was some work going on at the federal level looking at Asian predator controls mm-hmm. for this and the possibility of importing those Asian controls. That's actually being considered? And that's a question. And I'm just wondering what thoughts have been going on with regard to the other predator control, the Asian beetles that we have now here that were imported to work with, I believe, soybeans, and now they're kind of like all over the place. I just wondered what the thought process was there.
Mr. Abrahamson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as to the natural enemies of emerald ash borer from Asia, that work has actually already been done by USDA. So they collected three species of wasps from Asia, and they brought them back here to a containment lab where they were tested for their specificity to emerald ash borer. So they were addressing the issue of would these potentially cause some other kind of impact. The result of that testing was that they would not have any other impact than on emerald ash borer. And so those were approved to be released at the federal level. And in fact, they have since then established a rearing facility for those agents in Michigan and are in the process of rearing them and distributing them for use by states with emerald ash borer infestations. In Minnesota, we're not yet at the point where we would really be a viable release site because we have a pretty early infestation that may not even be able to sustain parasitoids if they were to be released. So we're not quite to that point here in Minnesota. As to the question on Asian lady beetles, I can't address that. I might ask Bob if he can address that, as I know he did his PhD on that. And I guess that's really it.
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Chair, Representative, The history with the multicolored Asian lady beetle, that predator was brought in dating back into the early 1900s, and it was released for control of pests of pecans and other tree crops like that. It wasn't brought in for soybean aphid control, but that was, I guess, kind of just a nice coincidence. The Asian lady beetle came from Asia. Soybeans came from Asia. The soybean aphid came from Asia. So through time, humans kind of brought that whole system over here. And, you know, that they are beneficial in providing control of some level of control of that pest. But as we all know, they have those adverse impacts coming into our homes, causing allergies for people, tainting wine because of their attraction to grapes in the vineyards. And I guess as to why that was allowed to happen, that predator was brought into the U.S. in an era of biological control where there wasn't a whole lot of concern about these non-target or non-intended impacts. A lot of times it took more of a shotgun approach where they would go over and collect a whole suite of natural enemies, predators, parasitoids that might attack that pest and then release them here and hope that one of them would work out. But like Mark was saying, times have really changed and there are these very strict testing procedures nowadays like the emerald ash borer parasitoids are going through.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up again for you, Mr. Cook. Do you have a list of invasive, species of different types that were, say, the predator particularly? Do you have a list of the ones that have been successful in controlling what they were brought over here to control and not becoming inadvertently problems in other areas, whether that would be humans in their houses or any of the other issues that you mentioned? Is there a list of which ones have actually worked?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cook.
Representative. Personally, we don't have a list like that within the department, but I think there has been some peer-reviewed scientific papers related to that, looking at the efficacy of various natural enemies that were brought in. Did they attain the goal that they were brought here for? And I'm pretty sure there are some of those studies that also look at the percentages of those that maybe have had adverse impacts. If you're interested, I could try to look into that and send it along to you.
I appreciate that.
And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Abramson, you had mentioned about dating of age of the infestations, and was that just a few trees that were dated, or in the St. Paul infestation, was an isolated dating, or was there kind of an analysis on the whole infestation?
Mr. Abrahamson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually it was a pretty comprehensive analysis that was done. We were able to take samples from 25 separate trees, and so that, in the estimation of the folks at Michigan State doing the work, was a pretty comprehensive sample that allowed a pretty good date to be assigned. And basically what you're doing with that, the samples that are obtained are cross-sections through the tree, and so they look at the cross-sections and establish a chronology looking at the growth rings of tree growth, and then they look at when the galleries for emerald ash borer begin to be found in those growth rings. And so that's how they're able to come up with the date. And it does, having a fair number of trees is important, because with a smaller sample, you run a greater risk of missing an earlier gallery than later.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then were the University of Minnesota trees the oldest infestation, or was it the ones that were in the neighborhoods?
Mr. Abrahamson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the oldest infested trees were in the original neighborhood near Hamden Park. And those trees were from 2006. And then as as the trees went out farther, they got subsequently younger infestations. Actually, the tree that was removed, that was infested on St. Paul campus, University of Minnesota, was only really fairly recently infested. We only found very little evidence of any galleries from the insect from before the current year, 2009. And the vast bulk of what we were seeing in that tree was very, very early larvae from 2009.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I ask that is that we've taken action about controlling firewood at state parks, but there are other entities where people gather, and maybe they have fire pits or where there's a lot of people in a short period of time that may be bringing things with them. I think like up in Representative Saylor's area, there's WE Fest. You know, people probably are going and bringing firewood along, maybe the state fair, camping at that. Other things where people go bringing with them potentially firewood. So is there anything, are there any procedures or policies or practices that we should be doing beyond what we have done already?
Mr. Abrahamson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think probably the primary thing that we need to do is continue to do outreach in as many different ways as we can to try and bring this to people's attention and let them know how serious it is. One of the things that we've been trying to do in St. Paul, as each time we find a pocket of infested trees, we get information to that neighborhood in the form of either a flyer that's dropped off or mailed to the addresses in that area, you know, alerting them to infested trees being present there, and letting them know where, if they have ash trees that they or ash material they need to get rid of, where it can be taken within the quarantine, the risks of moving it in firewood. And I think that is something that we have to continue to do. It seems to me that one thing that we should be looking at trying to do more is to catch people, and when I say catch, I mean catch their attention at the places where they're recreating. So more information that they're getting at campgrounds, at the places where they're using the firewood, because from the experience that I've had and from some, I guess I would say, somewhat informal studies that have been conducted over the past couple of years, it seems to me that the places where people are getting their knowledge about firewood are the places where they're using it, more so than what they're reading in the newspaper or seeing on a website or something like this. So I think, you know, Luke Skinner had mentioned that before, that people really get a lot of information from the signs at the boat landings. And I think that's something that I'd like to see us put more attention into in terms of outreach, is trying to get to people at the places where they're actually using the wood and thinking about it.
And Representative Joskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Abrahamson, you piqued my interest with the discussion on the multicolored Asian lady beetle. I'm curious of what you're seeing, and it's a little bit off track, but it's certainly related, the dynamics of that population in the soybean aphid. It appears that both of those populations are diminishing in their, at least in my part of the state in southeast Minnesota. Curious what's going on there. Are they naturally coming under control after a certain amount of time, or what are you seeing?
Mr. Abrahamson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, actually a few years ago I did used to work quite a bit with soybean aphid, but it's been since 2006 that I began working at Emerald Ash Borer, so I'm not really familiar with what's going on with soybean aphid and multicolored Asian lady beetle right now, so I really can't say. Refer to Bob Cook if maybe you have something to add.
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think to address your question, with the arrival or invasion of a lot of new invasive species, we see a huge influx in the population, a huge growth, explosion, and then shortly after that, they kind of decline and settle in, kind of like you're referring to. With the soybean aphid and multicolored Asian lady beetle, I don't know that there's any data to support it, but there have been a lot of anecdotal reports that they seem to have kind of entered into a cycle where you'd have a high year or two of the aphid and the beetle, and then followed by a lower year or two, and it would continue to fluctuate like that. And you know, I've been out of that loop for a little while with the lady beetle and soybean aphid, so I've been pretty much focusing on emerald ash borer. But before I did leave the Asian lady beetle world, I think there was a decrease in the number of reports and complaints that we would receive while I was at the university and in my first year or so at the MDA as well.
Okay. Thanks. Are there any other questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And next Thursday we will be having a hearing on PCA rules, and we'll see you then. Meeting is adjourned.